Well, good evening. A fine Wednesday it is. Keith said we only had two more nights. I feel like I was thinking, you know, this is, if we include this one, there's three more, right? I didn't know if maybe he knew something I didn't know. If we're going to be cutting this short, maybe there were complaints. Oh, boy. Thanks so much for coming. We're so tickled to have you. I have the honor and privilege of eating with Jack and Caroline Freeman tonight. People I have known since I was thin and their hair was dark. Now you just think about how long that must have been. What a precious couple there. I love them dearly. And it's been wonderful to be associated with them and with the rest of you all these years. I love the people of this church. I love this church. And I'm so glad that y'all have invited me to come back and be with you, because there's a lot of me that's tied to here and to you. And I'm so thankful for that. And we're so thankful, too, that people are visiting with us. I'm going to talk tonight about somebody who exemplifies about as well as any other person in the Bible that we all make mistakes. There's a man that is said twice in the Bible. He is a man after God's own heart. He is the exemplar. He is the king upon which the Messiah would be based, King David. And King David was an impressive figure. He was an amazing man. His stories are told with tremendous reverence, and the Messiah would be called, in fact, the Son of David. That would be one of the ways by which he'd be identified, not only through lineage, not only through his physical birth, but also through the mechanisms of David. But David, although he was an incredible man, and he did wonderful things for God, David did make some mistakes. Now, I don't want to just talk flat out about the mistakes that David made tonight. What I want to talk about is how he made mistakes that were not necessary. Now, sometimes you just make bad decisions. But sometimes you put yourself in a bad place where a bad decision seems like the only one you can make. And what I want to talk about is, how do we avoid getting in the bad place where the bad decisions are getting made? You see, carelessness is a completely avoidable condition. What we're talking about is negligence. When a person should be something that they're not, or some place that they aren't, or when they are some place they could have avoided, or they're doing something they could have changed if they hadn't neglected something that needed taken care of. Something that must be done, something must be dealt with, something that needed their attention. And David exemplifies this in an awful lot of ways. So I want you to think about what it is that's in your hands. If you want to, if it helps you, I want you to cup your hands together tonight. I want you to just clasp them in front of you. And I want you to think about, what has God put in my hands? What belongs to me? What is my stewardship? What am I tasked with tending to? Those are my business. Now I want you to think about that, because those are the things about which we tend to get careless. And sometimes we believe automatic is the setting. We put things, we don't want to be manual transmission wives, which I just love a manual transmission. I love a stick. We want the automatic. Fix it, forget it. And that's not the way life is, especially with the things that God has given us. What is in our charge to keep? God expects an answer for those things. And as a result, we have responsibility to deal with those things with thought, with intention, with planning, and looking away with some foresight, saying, what's going to be needed? What am I going to have to do? And listen to me when I say this. All the distractions in the world should not dissuade us from dealing with the things that really do belong to us. You see, the devil wants to fill up that cup with things that aren't your business. They're not your problems. They're not your interests. They don't have anything to do with your eternal nature. And if he can fill your cup with his junk, there's no room for the things of God. Does that make sense to everybody? And that is where our friend David made a lot of those mistakes. So turning the Old Testaments to the book of 2 Samuel. Originally, of course, these two books were just one book. And in the account of Samuel, you see the beginning of the United Kingdom of Israel. They didn't have kings for quite some time. They had a period of judges where God would send deliverers and help them, and they'd help them make decisions and choices and help them be faithful to God. But then God gave them a king. That was Saul. We talked about him last night. And Saul messed up pretty bad. And so God replaced him. He said, the man I choose will be a man after my own heart, a man of my choosing. And David is the man that he chooses, the son of Jesse. And David is largely a heroic figure. But I want you to look at a few things here in 2 Samuel where we see David makes some pretty bad mistakes. Number one, in 2 Samuel, the 11th chapter, I want you to read these first five verses with me. This is one of the most famous mistakes that David makes. I want you to see how David doesn't just make a bad decision. David puts himself in a bad place to make a bad decision. He does that twice in this text. In 2 Samuel, the 11th chapter, beginning in verse 1, it happened in the spring of the year, at the time when kings go out to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him, and all Israel, and they destroyed the people of Ammon and besieged Rabbah. But David remained at Jerusalem. Then it happened one evening that David arose from his bed, and walked out on the roof of the king's house. And from the roof he saw a woman bathing. And the woman was very beautiful to behold. So David said and inquired about the woman. And someone said, is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite? Then David sent messengers and took her. She came to him, and he lay with her, for she was cleansed from her impurity, and she returned to her house. And the woman conceived, so she sent and told David and said, I am with child. Did you notice verse 1? David should have been someplace else. It was a time of war, a time of spring. That's when kings went out to battle. That's different than it was than it is now. You know, in our world today, the higher your ranking is, the less likely you are to be in the front where all the fighting's happening. Do you know that? They send all the grunts to do all the heavy lifting. But the guys with the most stars and the bars and the marks and all the different things that indicate that they're way up on that, they're way back here saying, go get them, tiger! And that's about the way that goes. In the old days, the king took the point. The king was in front. The king was the leader. He was the general. And when kings went to war with their nations, they fought in those battles. And it's very much like that here in the time of David. But the whole army was out doing their thing. They was at home. And the more you know about David, the weirder this is. David is a mighty man of battle himself. He's a giant killer. He is a tremendous man. There's even a famous pop song about David during the time of his life. Now, it's one thing to have someone write a song about you, be John Henry or somebody, where a song gets written about you after you're dead. It's a totally different sort of existence to be a person that they write songs about you while you're alive. And there was a song that was being sung in Israel. Let me tell you how famous this song was. Even the Philistines knew this song. This was one of the top 40 of that day. It was the number one with a bullet all over the area. It was an international crossover hit. Saul had slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. I really don't know how the tune went. They did not survive. But we know the lyric. And a guy who's been tasked with that, who's been given the accolade of being the 10,000s killer, the giant slayer David, the king of Israel, when it comes time to go to war, is sitting home. Well, that ain't right, is it? Right away, he's in the wrong place. He has put himself through neglect of his duty in a place that he shouldn't have been. And what happens is in this particular place, he sees something he should not have seen. He saw a woman who was bathing at the top of her house. Now, normally, that's probably not too big a deal, because if you can bathe on the roof of your house, Most people probably can't see you, but the king's house is way up high, see? He can see all the way around. But you know what? He shouldn't be home. So maybe if you want to take a bath on your roof, you weirdo, if that's what you want to do, maybe it's not so dangerous. But she is bathing on the roof. And David is at home. And David looks at her. And what David should have done, I'm going to show you. Can you see me clearly? David, as he walks around on the roof and looks at all his kingdom, and he comes across, and there's Bathsheba. There's your, whoa, hey. And gone back inside. And maybe call one of the servants and say, can you send a message to the lady across the street about getting some blinds or maybe curtains or something around that bathtub? Can you tell her, I can see what the stork brought her. You know, I can see her in all her natural glory when I'm on my roof, and I think she should get some clothes on. Can you do that for me, please? See, that would have been something like what he did. But because David has careless eyes, because he sees a beautiful woman, he says, well, what do we have here? He likes women. David really likes women. And so he could have left well enough alone, say, bah, shouldn't have looked at that girl. I shouldn't be out on the roof when she, shouldn't have done that. But he doesn't. He takes his careless eyes and he transforms that into his careless mind. And this man, who should have left well enough alone, takes that woman and lays with her and gives her a baby. And when he finds that out, he uses his careless mind to come up with a plan to cover the whole thing up. But because her husband is too honorable a man and will not find the comfort in his wife's bosom like David means for when he brings him back out of the battlefront, he's where he needs to be. He's a soldier. He's where the battle's at. And David brings him from the battle and brings him home, and he wants him to lay with his wife so that it's natural, it's normal for her to have a baby 9 months later. And no one will think anything of it. But Uriah sleeps on the front porch. He won't go in. He says, if my brothers can't come home and find comfort with their wives, I shall not do that myself. And David tries to get him drunk. Have you ever heard of that? I've heard of people trying to get other people drunk so they can go to bed with them. I've never heard of anybody getting somebody drunk trying to get them to go to bed with somebody else. He develops this elaborate scheme just to cover this mistake up. Instead of just saying, I did it. That was bad. I shouldn't have done that. And when that doesn't work, he sends a letter to the battlefront, to the generals. And he says, I want you to put Uriah in the heat of the battle. And I want you to fade back from him so that he's by himself, so that he'll be killed in the battle. And you know how he sends the note? You know how he sends the letter to give that order? He sends it with Uriah. He sends it with the guy he intends to kill. Then, after Uriah dies, he takes up with his woman. They have the baby. And he's punished greatly because of that. They lose that child. And friends, don't forget, when you read this passage, this is not all happening in the space of just a few months. That baby may have been as old as 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years old by the time that happened. Did not happen at once. And why did it happen? Was that necessary? I mean, sometimes you get pushed in the corner, you make some bad mistakes, maybe you're rushed, but was any of that necessary? It was not. It was all because of carelessness. And one careless mistake piled upon another and upon another and upon another. Well, there's an awful lot of other stuff, and we're going to have to go through this pretty quickly because we don't have time to read all of these passages. I'm going to give you some homework. I'm going to reference for you some things out of 2 Samuel, the 13th chapter. I want to tell you a little bit about what happened with some of the children of David. David had 19 sons with many different women. and had some daughters too. But some of these children are only partially related to each other as a result of that. And one of these fellows is named Amnon, and he falls in love with his half-sister, Tamar. And he wants her, and so he takes her. He schemes to take this girl. And he takes her purity. And I want you to notice in this passage, there's something terrible. And I want you, parents and grandparents, and the people who are going to be dating, I want you to see something that is consistently true. When Amnon got what he wanted from this girl, as much as he thought he loved her, this infatuation he had for his half-sister, he was obsessed with her. He plotted until he got this thing set up so he could take her virginity. But after it all happens, verse 15 says of chapter 13, then Amnon hated her exceedingly, so that the hatred with which he hated her was greater than the love with which he had loved her. And Amnon said to her, rise and be gone. When a piece of trash like that gets what he wants, that girl is kicked to the curb. Now, Tamar has a brother whose name is Absalom. And he hears about this, and he is furious. And frankly, David hears about this. Verse 21 says, when David, King David, heard all these things, he was very angry. But if you look over this text and examine it and scour it with a brush, you will not see David taking one step of action toward this boy, his son. He doesn't do anything. So over the course of the next 2 years, Absalom plots a circumstance where he can get Amnon at dinner and off his guard and murder him in what looks like a gang war attack. And then Absalom has to flee because he's afraid something bad might happen to him. And I'll just thank you to notice in this text, you go home and read the whole thing, David doesn't do anything about that either. This one boy rapes his half-sister, and the other one murders his half-brother for that activity. And what does David the Mighty do about any of that? Not a blessed thing. He's angry. Well, is that all there was? Then Absalom comes back. And frankly, I'll tell you, I think this story is structured the way it is so that you and I will see something. Absalom is emboldened by his father's lack of attention to these issues, by the fact that there's no discipline or justice whatsoever administered. And Absalom comes back, and what he does is he begins to woo the people of Israel away from his father. And he does that with the purpose of staging a coup. He wants to take the kingdom away from his dad and become the king himself. So in chapter 15, these first several verses, what you see is Absalom develops a system of flattery and bribery in which he talks to people who are coming to get justice in the palace court. And he says, oh, I wish I was in charge. I wish I could give you justice. Don't you know Absalom loves you? You're just wonderful. And he kisses him and he flatters him. Verse 6 down here says, in this manner Absalom acted toward all Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men in Israel. And after he's got enough people gathered together, he bides his time. And on the appointed day, they lash out and they try to take over the kingdom. And what do? They succeed. David runs away from his kingdom because of his own sin. Now, there's something to be said about what David's doing here. David is a mighty man of battle, and he's an incredible soldier, and he's a killer of men. And some people have speculated, well, David's leaving Israel so he won't kill Absalom. But I want you to notice something that's in the text here, in the middle of this open rebellion, in chapter 18, skip over a few pages there, the war, it's going on. And they are embattled. And David has to be moved from place to place because Absalom has a plan, and he's being advised by a man named Ahithophel to bring all of the people away from David and isolate him so that he can kill only the king. And then he can bring all of the people back home and they'll all be faithful to Absalom. But what he doesn't know is David's got a spy in the court who advises against the advice of Ahithophel, and he's protecting the kingdom from any further damage. And so Absalom actually takes the advice of David's spy instead of the advice of Ahithophel. And the war continues to rage, and the counsel of God is against Absalom. And so when Absalom is in the battle and fleeing, well, you know what happens, don't you? He's going to be killed. But look at the language of David. When he's talking to his generals, he says in 2 Samuel 18, verse 5, "Deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom." All the people heard when the king gave all the captain's orders concerning Absalom. Now I want you to put all this together for just a second before we get to the end of that story. You got incestuous rape, he doesn't do anything. You got murderous vengeance, he doesn't do anything. You've got a bloody coup that's currently going on where people are dying and his life is in danger from his own child. And he says, "Take it easy on him, he's just a boy. He's just a boy who's raised an army and convinced a nation to betray you and stab you in the back." He goes, "Oh, be easy on him. He's just a kid." And when Absalom is discovered hanging from his glory, his hair, he cuts it once a year. And so it's long and it's beautiful. And he was a beautiful man. The text makes it abundantly clear. This woman, she had beautiful kids. And Absalom was one of those beautiful children. And he gets caught by his long hair in a terebinth tree. And he's hanging there. His animal runs right out from under him. And he's just hanging there by his hair. And one of David's captains stabs him in the heart with a spear. And then the men surround him and kill him. They throw him in a hole and they cover that hole with rocks. And they come back to tell David and they say, "May the king live forever. Those who would be your enemies are destroyed." And all David can say, the next two times David speaks, all he can say is, "Oh, Absalom, Absalom, had it been me rather than you, my son Absalom." Going on a little bit further, if you look in 2 Kings, the first chapter, if you need to flip over quite a few pages to get to that one, he has another son whose name is Adonijah. This is when David's gotten a little bit older. And I'm going to just suggest to you that Adonijah has watched what happened with Amnon and Tamar and Absalom and Absalom's coup. And Adonijah decides, "Well, you know what? That wasn't such a bad idea. Let's take the kingdom away from David." And so he does that same trick. But in this text, in 1 Kings, the first chapter, in this text is the clue we've been looking for that explains why the things happened to David and his children that happened. And it's right here in 1 Kings, first chapter, verse 5, it says, "Then Adonijah, the son of Haggith, exalted himself, saying, 'I will be king.' And he prepared for himself chariots and horsemen and 50 men to run before him. And his father..." David, his father had not rebuked him at any time by saying, "Why have you done so?" He was also very good looking. His mother had borne him after Absalom. Now you could just look at this text and say, well, the lesson is it's dangerous to be good looking because all the people who caused trouble were good looking. Well, that's not the point. The point is these people behaved the way they did for a rather specific reason. David has a lot of kids. You know why? He's got a lot of wives. And he's busy doing a lot of stuff. There's a lot of conquesting. There's a lot of vengeance being taken. There's a lot of blood being spilt. And frankly, it looks to me, when I look at the text and I study it over and over again, what it looks to me like is that David didn't give a whole lot of time to raising children. He didn't take time to be a father to these children. And this text bears that out. You look at what it says there again in verse 6. He had not rebuked this boy, Adonijah, at any time by saying, "Why have you done so?" Now that's the New King James. The New American Standard says his father had never crossed him at any time by asking, "Why have you done so?" The New International Version said his father had never interfered with him by asking, "Why do you behave as you do?" Do you know what the job of parents is? It is to interfere. The book of Proverbs makes it abundantly clear. It says, "Foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child, but the rod of correction will drive it far from him." Do you know why we call some people childish? Because they're behaving in an immature way. It's a way not fitting of their years. It's something that's not befitting the dignity of an older person. You know why we call them childish? Because we expect children to act dumb because they don't know any better. We don't expect adults to act dumb because they should have advanced beyond that. And so how is it that you bring a person from childishness to adulthood? You have to get in the way. You have to question them. You have to cross them. You have to stop them. You have to rebuke them. You got to spank them. You got to time out them. You got to do all kinds of stuff. You got to ground them. This is what Amy and I started describing years ago as commando parenting. You do whatever it takes. What you are, and listen to me when I say this, you are at war with somebody who wants that kid to go to hell. And you got to pull out all the stops to prevent that from happening. And so the first thing you have to learn as a parent is your kids will have plenty of friends. Don't try to be their pal. You got to be the mama. You got to be the daddy. And I said it probably Sunday, I think it was. We heard some pretty good advice when I was younger. Someone said, if your kids don't hate you occasionally, you're not doing a good job. I believe that. I believe that with all my heart. Because you're getting in the way of what they want to do. You're preventing them from doing things that they want to do. And if you never stop that child from getting what they want, they're going to end up with some bad things. They're going to end up in bad places with bad friends, involved in bad stuff. Have you ever heard somebody explain how they got incarcerated or how they got in trouble by saying, "Well, I was just in the wrong place at the wrong time"? You ever hear that? And they say that like it's a boxed-in explanation. Like, "I didn't deserve to get in trouble. I was in the wrong place at the wrong time." Well, sometimes that's true. Sometimes you are coincidentally where the piano falls out of the apartment where they're trying to move it. That's a coincidence. That's an accident. But if you associate yourself with drug-taking, booze-drinking people, and they get arrested for boozing and drugging, you're in the wrong place at the wrong time. You're in the wrong place because you're dumb. You're in the wrong place with the wrong kind of people because you chose those for friends. You see, that kind of thing just duplicates. And if you don't stop the child who has the foolish idea that they can jump off the roof and with a towel tied around their neck, they could fly because now they got a cape. If you don't disabuse that child of that notion, guess what kind of problem you're going to have when they're a teenager, or when they're in their 20s, when they're in their 30s. The problem David has here is that he's being careless with his children. They just do whatever they want. They run around. And see, these poor people had compounded the problem of having an absentee father, someone who wasn't paying attention, someone who wasn't actually disciplining them. They were, had their problems compounded by being born with a silver spoon in their mouth and being beautiful. Those are burdens when you're a person who's never been taught right from wrong. Because you get away with whatever you want, and with different classes of people. Some people will let you do what you want because you're beautiful. Some people let you do what you want because you're the king's kid. Some people let you do what you want because you're rich. Some people let you do what you want because they're not paying attention. Oh, that's your dad. And all of those things are unnecessary. All the problems that he has with his kids were completely avoidable. All he had to do was parent. That's it. He could have rebuked these kids. He could have spanked them, disciplined them, grounded them, time outed them, taken away whatever the equivalent of the Xbox or the PlayStation was during that time. He could have taught them some lessons. But did he? Well, in a word, no. Do you know what the word discipline means? It means teaching. So while I do advocate spanking, I do not advocate beating. If you touch a child and they didn't learn, you didn't discipline. Even if it's just a little tap. If you lash out to a child in anger or frustration or because you're embarrassed, you've abused that child. Even if it's just a little tap, a little touch, even if it's not touching off, it's just words. Abuse is very different than discipline. Discipline teaches. But on the other hand, if that child's suffering, got a little welt, a little handprint, I'll just be honest with you. I hope this is, you know, the statute of limitations has expired. I've absolutely left handprints on the little fat legs of some one little boy and little girl that I happen to know. Because they needed to be taught. And my words weren't getting through. And then, they were paying attention. You see what I'm saying? That's when you can get through sometimes. Oh, but then you have people saying, they're just a baby, they're just a kid. I'll never forget, my father changed his attitude about corporal discipline extremely from the time I was a child to the time I had my first child. I heard the phrase I never thought I'd heard Bob Arnold say. Giving Matthew a spanking one day, and he said, "Oh, Phil, he's just a boy. Like, you're just an old guy trying to get into heaven. Don't give me that." It takes a hard person to say no to a beautiful person, to an adorable person, to a cute person, to not be so distracted by the loveliness and the adorableness and the memories and the warmth and the and get to the business that child needs someone to raise them. They don't need any friends. They got all the friends they'll ever need. They'll make new ones if they lose these. And if you keep them away from the ones that aren't any good, they'll find better friends. You've got to have the confidence that it takes that when you step in and do your job, that is productive. It matters. It makes a difference. And I'll tell you, from the perspective of when that's happening, sometimes it takes a long time to see the fruit. I'll never forget. We established a rule. When we started giving the kids cell phones, and they didn't get them nearly as soon as they wanted. They waited 2 or 3 years to get their first cell phones. But when we gave them a cell phone, we live in a Cape Cod, and their bedrooms are upstairs. There's a bathroom up there. And our bedroom's on the ground floor there. In the living room, kitchen, all that kind of stuff. At night, when you went to bed, your phone went right there on the risers, the stairs, going up to the upstairs. And it was very convenient. There's a plug right there. You can charge it. So it's ready to go the next day. And Daddy and Mama knew the code to get in your phone. So after you went to bed, if they wanted to look at your texts or what you've been downloading, what you've been looking at on the internet, or what it was that you had been who you've been calling. We could just take a good gander at that. We could take our sweet time because you're upstairs in bed. We caught a couple of shenanigans like that. And we put an end to it. And so much sooner than I thought. I think Matthew may have gotten his first phone when he's 13, something like that. Is it about that age? He's 17 years old. He's a junior in high school. And he comes and he says, you've been studying the effects of sleep deprivation on the psychology of humans. And he said, while we're sitting in this room, all of us high school students, there's a 2/3 of the class just having a hard time staying awake. And the reason they're having a hard time staying awake, listening to the dangers of sleep deprivation, it's because they all have their phones in their bedrooms and their friends are all texting them in the middle of the night and they're all sending them messages in the middle of the night and people are sending dirty pictures to them and all the different kinds of things that are happening and their parents aren't watching any of that. And he said, brace yourself, thank you all for not letting us take our phones upstairs. 17. What? That was a whole lot earlier and I thought we were going to hear it. I thought they had to go away and have their own kids and come back before they apologized. But they started seeing it. We wouldn't let them have a boyfriend or girlfriend until they were 16 of any kind. They could hang out with friends. They could say they liked people. They could talk about how cute somebody was. And they could tell their friends they'd like to go. They could say whatever they want. But they weren't allowed to date anybody. And I'll tell you what, that sounds like positively Gestapo tactics to some people. I know it does. And when you're watching the Disney Channel and the Nickelodeon stuff, and everybody who's 7 and older has a girlfriend or a boyfriend, boy, that feels like you're a stranger in a strange land all of a sudden. But our daughter come home from high school talking about the tremendous drama of the boyfriend-girlfriend dynamics that she had to deal with. And strangely enough, this girl who'd never had a boyfriend was the relationship counselor for all the girls at Jeffersontown High School. She gave the best advice, and her friends and their friends would come to her for advice because she wasn't tainted by the drama and the foolishness of people who don't know what love is telling each other they love each other. And she thanked us for that. I'm not telling you we did a great job. What I'm telling you is what sounds like a crazy bad idea to kids is sometimes a necessary rule for parents. If you want to raise them right, you got to do what it takes. And you can't say you're sorry for doing what it takes. You don't ever apologize for being a parent, for getting in the way, for interfering, for chastising, for rebuking, for saying no. You don't ever apologize for that. You're trying to save more than their lives. You're trying to save their souls. It is the most precious thing that they possess. And you are the one who informs them of that. You're the first place where they learn that. They learn about God from you. They learn about obeying God from you. And if they can't take you seriously, I promise you they won't take God seriously. And so you got to do whatever it takes. David was a constant problem for himself. When the time came in 1 Chronicles 22, he wanted so badly to build a permanent house for God. They'd been worshiping in a tabernacle, and that was a tent. It was a portable worship house that they would carry from site to site to site and site. And they've been living in Jerusalem with that tabernacle right there in their presence. It'd been moved from Gilgal, from Hebron, and now it's here. And David lives in a palatial estate. There's cedar and ivory and there's all these beautiful features and he's filthy rich. He's accumulated all these treasures in this glorious palatial house to live in. And he looks at the house of God and he says, that's a tent. How do I live in a house like this and God lives in a tent? So he wanted to build God a permanent structure that was befitting the glory of God. And so he posits the idea with God and he says, I want to build you a house. And look at what the result of that was. 1 Chronicles 22, beginning in verse 7. David said to Solomon, "My son, as for me, it was in my mind to build a house to the name of the Lord my God. But the word of the Lord came to me saying, 'You have shed much blood and have made great wars. You shall not build a house for my name because you have shed much blood on the earth in my sight.'" And some people say, "Well, wait a second, didn't David shed a lot of blood for God? Didn't he go off on missions and fight wars and battles for God?" Yes. So what do you think God's talking about? God's talking about the vengeance and the red rage that David would go into when he was upset that he'd been personally crossed. David shed a lot of blood that didn't have to be shed. David wanted to kill a lot of people. He was prevented from killing. When you look at the story of Abigail, how he came to be Abigail's husband. He wanted to kill Nabal and everybody in Nabal's family. And she talked him out of it. That story is there for us to see the side of David that was out of control, passionately murdering people because he thought they needed killing. And that is what God's talking about right here. You're not talking about the conquests and the wars that he fought because God had enemies and they needed to be destroyed. He's talking about David's personal vendettas and how David executed those kinds of things. So let me tell you what this reminds me of. Excuse me. There are people in this world, and you know them. Some of you may be them, but everybody knows somebody who says something inane, ridiculous, outrageous, dumb, and then they follow it up with this beauty, this little gem. "Well, I'm sorry, but that's just the way I am." And they're saying that to excuse rudeness. They're using that to excuse stubbornness. They're using that to excuse uncontrolled rage. And they're saying, "I'm sorry," and they're not, "but that's just the way I am." And when someone says like that, I say this: "Well, the way you am is broke. You should seek to fix it. You need to get your passions under control. You should not be a braying donkey in the form of a human. You ought to be a human befitting the dignity of what God put in you, an eternal spirit. If you can't say anything nice, you know what Mama said? Don't say anything at all. If you can't say anything nice, you know what Phil says? Shut up. Because I'm not nearly as nice as my mom." And the whole idea that there are things about us that you have to accept because I can't control myself is sinful. It is an accusation against God. And if you do not seek to remedy those things, you are fighting against everything that God says, which is, "I made people good and I gave them the potential for good." And if we build an appetite for things like rage, like foolishness, like sin, like having our own way and selfishness, we can expect to go to hell. We can count on it. But what we cannot expect is for people to excuse our behavior as if it doesn't matter, because you know it does. Jesus didn't die for me to be able to be a jerk. And for the people of God to lower themselves to the level of the common street person when they have been delivered by the blood of the Lamb into the grace of the kingdom of God is a disgusting way to continue to live your life. We mustn't ever do that. When we say, "Well, that's just the way I am," we're troubling ourselves. We cannot just let that continue. David didn't manage his passions. He didn't manage his body. He didn't manage his mind. He didn't manage his eyes. He didn't manage his kids. And friends, every one of those things, it was unnecessary. He didn't have to be those things. He had the choice to do something completely different. And how do I know? Because billions of people since then have done differently. Certainly some have done worse, but others have done better. And we are not saddled with what we were raised to be. We are not saddled with what society made us to be. We were gifted with the free will in which God instills every human the right to choose their own destiny. You can go to heaven, friend. I don't care how bad your mom and daddy was. I don't care how bad your circumstances were. You can go to heaven. You don't have to duplicate the patterns of your parents and your grandparents and all the humans who came before you. You can change everything you want about yourself. It's not necessary to go down those same roads. So let me show you with you one more thing before we finish up and give a few little applications. What's happening in 1 Chronicles 22 is David is finally reaping some of his wild oats. You know the old joke that a lot of people go out sowing the wild oats and then they pray for a crop failure? Well, David's eating the ashes of what he's been burning down right here. Listen, he's not the same man in 1 Chronicles 22 that he was when he rode up in a hot rage wanting to kill Nabal. He's not even the same young man he was who killed that giant on that great field between the Philistines and the Israelites. David's an old man who's lost a lot of his influence, who had to put down two coups started by his own children. He's a tired old guy who wishes he could have built God's house, and he can't. And he's burned so many bridges behind him. He's lost the influence that once belonged to him by virtue of God's choosing him to lead his people. And here he is in a sorrowful state that he is now genuinely incapable of changing. And he would have built the house of God. When you get to the part of this book in just a few chapters, 1 Kings, when Solomon builds the temple, it is the most mind-boggling thing that had ever been built. It is covered inside and out with gold and jewels. And one of the reasons Solomon's temple can be so glorious is because David set so much stuff aside, so many resources and money and gold to build it, that Solomon could add to that and make it magnificent. But David wanted to build it and shot himself in the foot by living his youth in a wasteful way and being careless at other times in his life. How long does it take to win back your influence if you lose it? Friends, it takes a moment to lose all the good that you've built. And it takes so long to build it back. And if you've made a terrible mistake and you've violated the trust of the people who love you, it takes longer to get that trust back than it did to get it the first time. And so we must never get careless. And on that subject, I just want to reemphasize to you who are parents, to you who are grandparents, you get one shot with these kids. There is one era of their time where they are most influenced by you. And some of you are looking at me like, well, I've raised my kids. You've got grandkids. I never knew either my maternal nor paternal grandfathers. They were both dead before I was born. But some of you, your peepaw and your papaw and your pappy and your granddaddy and your grandpa, and when children say those words, their hearts swell. There's something real special about being somebody's papaw. There's something uniquely qualifying about being granny. About being mamaw. And those kids look to you for for things they won't even get from their parents. And you've got one window. And I'm going to tell you, you can waste that by only giving them pie and cookies and sugar and cake and fun and videos and games. Or you can give them the pie, the sugar, the cookie, the videos, the games, the chocolate, and all that kind of stuff, and you can give them God. You can give them God in a way that says, all the way up until my death, I can serve God and be happy. I can serve God and be loyal and faithful, and I can have an influence on other people. Your life is telling them how important God can be forever to them. And that's especially true if their parents aren't saying the same things. But if you've got a shot right now, you've got to get them in Bible classes. You've got to get them here at worship services. You've got to make it regular in their lives so that every once in a while something sinks in. One word or two words every week. After 52 weeks, some of it starts to soak in. And they don't even realize they're paying attention. But it's soaking in. The songs are positively mnemonic devices. Talk to any professor at any education university and they'll tell you singing locks ideas in your head. That sense memory that's there. The smell of this building will be ingrained in the memories of the children who attend here. And if it's associated with you, it'll be warm. It'll be friendly. It'll be lovely. And they will always know where God can be found. Take the shot and do whatever it takes to make it count. When we procrastinate and we put off dealing with things that need to be dealt with, we sometimes miss opportunities altogether. And sometimes we don't miss the opportunity, but we get to a point where the trouble has collected so much interest behind it, you cannot solve the problem anymore because you're paying all interest. All interest. You never get to the principal. And when we ostrich ourselves, when we bury our heads in the sand, and we refuse to deal with issues of character in ourselves, and we refuse to deal with issues of character and sin in our friends and in our family. We refuse to deal with problems in our marriages. We refuse to deal with those kinds of things. And we just let them go, let them go, let them go, let them go. Habits form. And habits make character. And character can condemn. When someone learns how to lie and learns how to gossip and learns how to fornicate, learns how to drink, learns how to do those things, those appetites don't go away just because they stop doing those things. There's a track that goes from your mouth and your eyes and your ears and your fingertips to the pleasure center of your brain. And when you tread that path until it's nice and flat and warm, your brain always knows how to get it. And it will always tell you, we need another drink. We need another shot. We need some more porn. We need a little more gambling. We need some more sex. We need a little more of what we used to get. A little of the hair of the dog that bit us. We need that to deal with the stress and the pressure and the difficulty. And if we don't deal with those things as soon as we realize they're problems, they become giants. They are so difficult to slay. But we can't do it alone. So if you're already at that point, stop putting it off and get whatever help you need. But if you see those things starting, stop them dead in their tracks. If you see those things starting in your kids' lives, your grandkids' lives, stop them dead in their tracks. And someone says, oh, but if I do that, they might take those grandkids away from me. If you don't stop, you'll not see those grandkids in heaven. And you think you've got a tragedy on your hands right now. You wait till you get to the bar of judgment and you find out they're not there. There will be nothing that will pain you like that. Nothing. And I told you what I said to my kids and I say it to them to this day. If you go away from the Lord, you've gone away from me because he is so integrated to what I want to be. But if you don't follow him, I can't follow you. You can't give me what I'm longing for. And friends, this is the deal. We can give them that too. It's not a one or the other proposition. It can be everybody wins. But I think you see in David's life, compromising, letting kids have what they want, that never accomplishes any good. You know better. And the person who knows better should be the one who makes the judgments. Not the person who's confused. Not the person who's addled. Not the person who's ignorant. Not the person who is impaired by substances. Not the person whose vision is clouded by what the devil has thrown in front of them. You, who are spiritually minded, are to restore those who have been taken captive, to bring them home. Because you know better. And you can't do better. And they won't do better if you're not leading. You have seen, and I have seen so many times, people who spend the prime of their lives making money and getting stuff. And then they'd like to be a blessing to the church. They'd like to function in the church. There are some men who so ruin the youth that they have, they are disqualified from being elders. When in their older years and great wisdom, they would be a blessing to the church. There are women who would be tremendous assistance and helpful to their husbands being elders. But in the folly of youth, they burn up that flower and make it so that he can't be qualified either. There are people who would long so much to have their children go to heaven and be in church somewhere or with them or whatever it is. But because they didn't parent them or they let them go, whatever it was, they missed the door to get them in. And now they're playing catch up all the time. There's an older couple that worships with us. I have never been so impressed as I was with them. We had a big marriage class, and there's about 56 people there. I guess that's 23 couples, 20. No, that's, I don't do math. That's 28 couples, right? I'm really bad at math. I don't know what to tell you. And this old couple, they're 78, 80, 81, 82. He said, "Can I say something before we begin?" He said, "Sure, go ahead, John." He said, "I want you all who don't have kids or just having kids, I want you to hear me. I wish I could have back those years that you're living with right now, because I'd take my kids to church and every Bible class, and I'd have them there every Sunday, and I'd be there myself, and I'd be showing them how to do it. But because I did not do that, because I didn't live that example at home, because I did not do that, not one of my children is safe in the arms of the Lord today. And they're all walking away from Him day by day by day. And as I approach the gates of eternity, I do not have any expectation of seeing them there. And it is the greatest pain of my heart." He said, "I want you to do whatever it takes. And this class right here, I hope it's a good beginning." We can't put off dealing with things. We miss the opportunity to bless the church for now and for the future by selfishly pursuing the things that are not going to matter in just a few years. Unnecessary problems come because of our carelessness. Brother, there are necessary problems. There are things that come up because we just see things differently, and humans don't all agree on things, and sometimes it's necessary to have conflict. But I want you to consider something with me as I finish this, and I want you to hear this. What does everybody in this place think of a thief? What do you think of a thief? I've heard over and over again from people Brother Steele's age and people who are much older, because he's not that old. There's nothing worse than a thief. You ever heard that? Nothing worse than a thief. It's disgusting for hard-working people, decent people, To imagine that somebody would take something that you worked hard for and put in your blood, sweat, and tears to obtain. And it's just disgusting, isn't it? Friends, our carelessness is stealing from God. He puts in our hands resources and ability and time, and He says, make the most of these days. And we fritter those things away on our common pleasures, on our stupid entertainment, on our ridiculous physical appetites, on having our way and getting what we want. And that is nothing short of stealing. Behold, the day the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. As stewards who must give an account, let's approach every day like that and not be careless. Surely we can see what it cost David. Let me encourage you tonight. There's always at least one, and usually more than one, in any audience of this size that has avoided dealing with some stuff they need to deal with. The most important of those are the things that pertain to eternal life, spiritual existence forever. There are things we can do to ensure that we get to go to heaven. And there's life that we can live that makes sure we will not, that we will go to hell. And at this point, you certainly must have some grasp of what that's like. Now, if there's something out of order in your life that you've been neglecting to deal with, it's time for you to turn that around. The vessel needs to be righted. Take the right steps. If you've never obeyed the gospel, let's help you do that tonight. Take what faith you have in the Lord and commit your life to Him by repenting of the sins that you've once committed and turning away from those things, and make Jesus the Lord and confess before these people here tonight that He is your Lord. And we'll baptize you into Jesus Christ, put you in Him. God will take away your sins. You'll be in Christ. You'll become a child of God through faith in Him. And you can go on your way rejoicing. Maybe that there's other things in your life, even if you're a child of God, that you've been putting off dealing with. I recommend you go deal with them. Make the phone call. Say the thing. Write the letter. Do what it takes. But do something while you still have time. If we can encourage you or help you in some way, come right now as we stand and sing.